So good morning, everybody. It's a very exciting morning, very exciting Shabbos. It's Shabbos Chazak. We are finishing the entire Sefer of Bereishis as the world tonight, when the clock strikes 12, is going through its transformation from 2020 to 2021. We also are going through our transformation just one day later, going from Sefer Bereishis all the way to Sefer Shemos, which also represents a transition and a transformation in the story of Klal Yisrael, in the story of the Jewish people. Rabbi Sacks would write, which was the greatest story that was ever told to the entire world. And only he could say that in such a beautiful, powerful way. So it ends really the transition is the Jewish people moving from a family to a nation. That transition moves very, very quickly in terms of the text itself. We have Yaakov in our parsha, sitting around with his sons, in his final resting place, in his deathbed. We have Yaakov then eventually getting buried by his sons, traveling all the way back to Eretz Canaan to bury his children, for his children to bury him. And the Torah concludes with Yosef passing away and with the Shibut of Mitzrayim beginning. And that's where I want to begin right now with the first Rashi in the parsha. We're going to go back and forth between the sources themselves and between just talking one to one. So I would like to focus on the first Rashi. First Rashi tells us the following. When did the servitude begin? So the Vayichi Yaakov be'eret Mitzrayim. Yaakov lived in Mitzrayim. Rashi points out the following. Larma parsha zu stuma. The parsha of Vayichi goes straight from Vayigash. Normally, when you begin a new narrative or a new subject or a new topic in the Torah itself, there is a space in the Torah. There's a space. Sometimes you skip to the next line. Sometimes there's just like a blank white space in the line itself and you begin at the end of the line. Here it just goes. It continues. It flows from Vayigash to Vayichi, which we call a Parsha Stuma. When there is space, it's called a Parsha Psucha. Why is Parshas Vayichi, a Parsha Stuma? So Rashi writes that with the death of Yaakov, Nistemu Einehem Shel Yisrael, the eyes of the Jewish people were closed off, Mitzaras HaShibud, because of the pain and suffering that they experience through the servitude of Mitzrayim. With the death of Yaakov, the slavery begins. That's what Rashi says. That's why the Parshas Ustuma. The problem is, though, is that really true? Did our slavery really begin with the death of Yaakov? It doesn't, in fact. The slavery does not begin until much later on. Chazal even tell us that the slavery began only once the last one of the Shvatim died. I don't know who was the last one of the Shvatim to live. Who was the last Shevet to die? We would have thought it would have been Yosef, right? That's where the story was. It wasn't Yosef. Who was it?
Levi.
It was Levi. Levi was the last one. Once Levi died, that's when it triggered this slavery. So what is it? Is it this moment, which is what Rashi says? Or was it much later on? Or how do we understand Rashi in this context? So I'd like to share two different approaches as to what Rashi meant here, what the Shibud was. And they both getting onto the following point, which is it didn't happen in one moment. There wasn't like a flip of a switch where, oh, Yaakov died, quick, everybody get on chains, everybody, start building pyramids. We know it, maybe as young children, we thought that's the way it worked, but we know as adults, that's not the way things work. Things went slowly and gradually, but clearly there was a plan here where the Jews at one point became very, very prominent within society and very distinguished parts of the community. They were Paro's guests, the royal guests that joined, Yossi's family. Very, very chashev. Things changed, but very, very slowly. And we see a few different hints in our parsha to this gradual shift in perspective. One comes from the Akedas Yitzchak. The Akedas Yitzchak was an earlier commentary on the Torah. Rav Yitzchak Arama, he points out the following. He asks, that later on when Yaakov is buried, we the Torah points out that who takes him, who buries him? His children and some of the grandchildren go. Chazal say, Chushan, the son of Dan, was there. But it wasn't this huge funeral. Not all of his grandchildren were allowed to go, and not all of the great-grandchildren were allowed to go. Usually, a beautiful funeral. A funeral is beautiful. Sometimes they are beautiful. It's a celebration of the person's life. And why didn't they go? Was it too challenging to take all those kids on a flight? Was it not enough Dramamine to knock them out? What was it? Why not? So Visakha Rama says something very, very striking. He says that Paro was afraid. He had to let them go because that was a deal he made with Yosef, that Yaakov was going to be buried in Mitzrayim. And he wanted to agree to Yosef. Politically, it would have been a bad move if he didn't agree to Yosef at this moment. But he was afraid. Well, he was going to lose his people. He was going to lose his advisors. He was going to lose the brachos that came along with having the Jewish people in Mitzrayim. So he said, you guys can go, but you can't bring your whole family. They need to stay here. And Paro had in mind, they were collateral. If they end up staying in Eretz Israel, if they end up staying in Israel, their children will be left in Mitzrayim. So that never would happen. They would never leave their family behind. Therefore, they came back. But that already you see a shift. We need them here. We love them. This is more of a, there was something, more, dastardly that was behind this approach to Paro, that he needed to keep them here because he needed them for other motives, which again, later on, this enslavement, when that happened, you saw that come to fruition. But treating the Jewish people in a certain way, you're stuck here, was already a step in that direction. That is the approach. Yeah, one second, Mendy. That was the approach of Rav Rama. We'll get to Rav Schwab in a moment. Yeah, Mendy, go ahead.
So you said, this was a slow process. I think that's also happens with people who want to do this horrible act. We've seen this always in the past. You do things very slowly because you want to gauge the tempo of the people to see if they're on board with the act. So yeah. You go slowly. Then you can measure to see, are they agree with me? Or not. And I think we've seen that also, maybe even in the Holocaust also.
100%. There are a lot of parallels.
That the people got on board and then they had the total right to, they felt they had the total right to do whatever they wanted.
The initial laws that came out, in the 30s, and that slowly, it was a very slow process. There's a Ramban about that in the beginning of Parashat Shemot. Maybe we'll learn that next week. That discusses the gradual process. How could it be that Egyptian cultured moral society is going to take babies and throw them into the river? How was it? How could it be? So the Ramban discusses that gradual process about how Paro had this plan and how he did that very, very slowly. He first started accusing them of small, minor crimes and started, talking about them in a certain way. That's a big part of it. The propaganda of talking about the Jewish people as vermin was not something new in Germany in the 1930s. That was something that Paro already was doing. Vayishritzu comes from the language of sherets, of bugs, of insects. Already talking about them in a certain way makes them subhuman. And this was part of this plan. That was the approach of the Akedat Yitzchak. The Rav Schwab writes the following. He notes here that when Yaakov died, there already started a disconnect between Yosef and Paro. Whereas Yosef was viewed as the second in command that had, automatic access to the Oval Office, so to speak, automatic access to Paro's palace, that very quickly changed. The Pasuk says, Vayidaber al Beis Paro, Lemor, Imnach Masadichim Beinechem, Dabru na Bozne Paro Lemor. So when Yosef's asking permission to bring Yaakov to Mitzrayim, you see a subtle shift. Yosef doesn't go to Paro and say, Paro, I made a promise to bring my father and bury him in Canaan. What does he do? He speaks to Beis Paro, and he says to Beis Paro, to the house of Paro, the office staff, the advisor, the counselor. Can you please bring this message and speak to the ears, the Be'oznei Paro, speak to Paro himself, which is different. That wasn't the way it was originally. Slowly, this, as what once was a beautiful partnership between Yosef and Paro, was slowly, separating. There was a slow separation. And Rav Schwab writes about this, how there was this, a slow disconnect. The communication was more distant. And then eventually, again, gradually over not just years, not months or years, but it was decades. Decades started this shibud. And that's what Rashi means here. The shibud began gradually. It began outright. Once Levi died, yeah, they were building pyramids. But before that, this is a slow death of the Jewish people and Jewish life in Egypt. That is the thought number one for today. Really, two thoughts.
So there wasn't one incident then. It wasn't just one incident, you're saying. Slowly and gradually it built up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There was a buildup. Exactly. Number two. And this question, number two, is something we really could ask on any of the past several parashios, already beginning in Parashas Vayishlach, is that in Parashas Vayishlach, Yaakov fights against an angel and he wins. And as a prize for winning this battle with this struggle with this angel, with this Malach, Yaakov gets a name change. Now his name is Yisrael. And we notice that Yaakov's name is not only Yisrael now, as opposed to Avram and Sarah. There were Sarai and Avram. Their names change and they don't go back. They don't go back. They're Avraham and Sarah, right? But Yaakov's name fluctuates. Yisrael, Yaakov. Yaakov, Yisrael. And the Mefarshim point this out here in our Parsha in a few points. I'll just share one over here. Vayeged le Yaakov lemor, hine, vayomer hine bincha Yosef ba'elecha. They tell Yaakov that your son Yosef came to visit you. Yaakov is ill. He's sick. He's the elderly father. Your son Yosef came to visit you. Vayischazek Yisrael. Yisrael became strong. Vayeshev alamita, meaning the son, the elderly father is visited by his son. He wants to show that I still have a little strength, a little vigor left. So not Yaakov got up on the bed to sit up on the bed, but Yisrael got up on the bed. That's a clear, we would say, an inconsistency within this pasuk. Why the quick and swift name change from Yaakov to Yisrael right over here? A second example of this is Vayichi Yaakov Eretz Mitzrayim Shva Asrei Shana Vehi Yemei Yaakov Shnei Chayei Chayav Sheva Shanim Varba Meo Shana. The pasuk tells us that Yaakov lived in Mitzrayim for 17 years, and Yaakov's life was 147 years long. Vayikrevu Yemei Yisrael Lamus. And then the Torah tells us that the days of Israel, the days of Yisrael, were getting close to an end. So what? Yisrael, Yaakov, Yaakov, Yisrael. There are many, many different approaches to this. I like to share Rabbeinu Bechaya, and then one of my Rabbeim, Rabbi Michael Rosenzweig, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. So Rabbeinu Bechaya writes that whenever Yaakov is mentioned, it's referring to Yaakov in his physical form. Yaakov, physical actions that Yaakov does. And that fits. Right? Yaakov is sitting up. Yaakov is lying down in the bed. They tell Yaakov what happens. Then Rabbeinu Bechai, what's Yisrael? His spiritual motivation. When he's motivated spiritually to do something. Here, it wasn't just Yaakov moving and sitting up on the bed, but it was Yisrael. It was this inner drive that he had to move up. Yaakov, it wasn't only Yaakov that was dying, but the end of the days of Yisrael was also passed away. That's Rabbeinu Bechaya. Rav Rosenzweig explains, and again, you can probably find other proofs for either one of these throughout the Torah, that when Yaakov was acting for himself or was acting on behalf of him or his children, he was called Yaakov. It was a personal action. But when Yaakov is doing something, not just for him or for his immediate family. But when he was representing the Jewish people, he was Yisrael. That name changed. It flipped. So when the Torah tells us that Yaakov may have physically died in our Parsha, but Yisrael, that name, Yisrael, B'nei Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, those represent points of destiny for the Jewish people. That never changes. His legacy, right, the Yisrael, that lives on forever. Personal versus for the Jewish people, the national or the universal for the Jewish people. That is two differences there, Yaakov and Yisrael. Moving on to a question that Mendy asked in the pre-shir. I got on at 9:05. So Mendy asked the following question. When you look at some of the brothers, you'll notice that they're not really given blessings. They're not blessings per se. They're sometimes, we'd say in Yiddish, a patch and punim. They're like a slap in the face. Reuven, come here, my oldest child. You're a hasteful, pachas kamayim altosar. You're impetuous. You do things without acting. Like, what is that? So the greatest bracha that you can give somebody, you're right, it maybe is a little bit strong, but the greatest bracha that you can give somebody is when you can help them understand who they are, what their innate character traits are, the traits that God endowed them with, what they are. If we knew that, right, then that helps us when you have self-actualization, when we can know who we are, then that helps us determine our potential in life. And that gives us an ability to know where we should be and how we should move forward with decisions that we have in our life. Sometimes people move forward and they don't take the time in their life or to think about this or to speak to people to help them figure these things out. But after Shimon, after Reuven, we have Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi, it's even worse to a certain degree. By Shimon and Levi, we'll see right now, I'll get it up. The Torah tells us, they're achim klei chamas mecherosam. The Torah says about Shimon and Levi that the way that they work is with klei chamas. They use violent tools and weapons as their as the way that they interact with other people. That Shechem, they are the two. Rashi points out Shimon and Levi, the two brothers that together push Yosef into the pit. But the bracha that they're given is Alchein bi Yaakov vafitzein bi Yisrael. That Shimon and Levi are not given land in the land of Israel in the way that everybody else is. Shimon is not given contiguous land. We pointed this out in our Sefer Shoftim Shir, whereas every other tribe is given a large plot of land in Eretz Israel. Shimon is given different blot, like more, it's more blotchy. There's like, maps of the land of Israel based on the tribal land. Theirs is more blotchy. It's bits and pieces throughout. And Levi, we know, is not given land. They're given land as part of everybody else's land. Why is that? Leviim were working in the Mishkan, and people needed to give them their maaser and other priestly gifts, not for the Kohanim, Truman Maaser. And Shimon, why did they get these blotchy parts of land? They got it, Rashi says, because they became the teachers of Klal Yisrael. They became the Rebbeim and the Moras of the Jewish people. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, why is that? Right? On one hand, Yaakov in the same breath says, you guys are dangerous. Right? You guys are zealots. On the other hand, right after this, it sounds like a reward. Because you're zealots, I'm going to give you Vafitzein bi Yisrael. You'll get to be the Rebbeim. You'll get to be the teachers of Klal Yisrael. and you will get truma and maaser. So,
Rabbi,
yeah, go ahead. What do you think?
I think that one of the reasons why Levi excelled was because he separated himself from Shimon. You always see Shimon and Levi together, Shechem all over. Yes. As a matter of fact, you see Yosef. Who does he imprison when he's imprisoned Shimon? Because he knows he's the impetuous. He's the guy that's going to blow his stack. He's the guy that's going to make trouble. So I think Levi actually separates himself from Shimon. And that's one of the reasons he's no longer under the influence of Shimon. And therefore, he's able to excel.
Right. There's a lot to say about that in general. Chet Egel was a major demarcation point between these two tribes. Levi took one side, Shimon the other, Benos Moav as well. But Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky points out over here is that this trait of zealotry within itself is dangerous. But the reasons why they became zealots within itself was noble. They risked their lives because they were achedina. They were the brother. They saw something wrong and they needed to act upon it. No, none of the other brothers did anything. They were the ones that acted upon it. The danger is, what Mendy pointed out, is when there's too much zealotry. That's why Shimon and Levi couldn't be together. Yosef understood that. That's why he separated Shimon and Levi. That was understood even with the lands. They couldn't be together within themselves. It'd be too much, too unhealthy. But that's why, you know, sometimes you got to separate the two kids in class. You know, like, they're two kids. They're great on their own, right? They're passionate on their own. Peter and Carol, you'll tell me what story you're telling me. You're talking about it afterwards. But you're on their own, they're awesome. They're passionate. But together, it could be too much trouble. So that's what Yaakov wanted to tell them, is that your zealotry comes from a source of passion and a source of love for the Jewish people. So I'm going to put you in a position to excel. I'm going to put you in a position where you can help the Jewish people because you understand, you have love for the Jewish people, you care deeply, and you're willing to sacrifice a tremendous amount. Those are the Kohanim, the Rebbeim, and the teachers, and the Morot of Klal Yisrael all come from this source. This source of passion and dedication to Klal Yisrael. Therefore, that bracha is also, that klala also becomes a bracha, but it has to be harnessed in the right way. This is instructive for not just the children themselves to know themselves, but also for parents and also for educators as to know that and to understand these traits in their students or in their children, and to know how to not just manipulate, to maneuver them and put them always in the best position to excel. And Yaakov is trying to do that. I'm going to put you in the best position to excel where you guys can fulfill your potential. That ultimately was the bracha and was what Yaakov is teaching all of us as parents, grandparents, to always try to put our children in the place where they can always excel. So that is thought number three from Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. The bracha of Dan seems very, very, you know, the brachos of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, and Yosef get a lot of the real estate in the Torah. They're much longer. There's a lot more to say. They're the main players in the story itself. But we have the bracha of Dan. The bracha of Dan, the end of the bracha, it's very, very, very short. It's, two psukim. Is Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem, which is, you know, makes it into our tfilos from, you know, time and again. Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem. And read the Rashis in our Parsha. They're difficult, they're very, very long. And Rashi reads into all of the tribes how these are all prophetic in nature, that they're referring to, you know, future leaders that come out of these tribes. For example, Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem, Rashi says, our hope, you know, our salvation, we hope from Hashem. That's what it means. We throw our salvation to Hashem. That's referring to Shimshon HaGibor. Hopefully, we'll get to there in our Shoftim Shir. But it's referring to Shimshon HaGibor, who the Jewish people relied upon for salvation. And that's the way many of the Mefarshim take the the bracha of Dan, that it's referring to somebody in Dan's future. I'd like to share with you the Abarbanel. Rav Dan Yitzhak Abarbanel, the doctor of, you know, King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, says something really, really fascinating. He says here that this was not a bracha or talking about the future of the Jewish people or about the Shevet Dan, but it was more like the slogan of Dan, what Dan represented. Dan was the Ma'aseif L'chol HaMachanos. Dan, when the Jewish people traveled in the desert, Dan was the last of the Shvatim. They picked up the rear of the Shvatim. So they were the most susceptible to danger from the, and attacks from the outside. Everybody else was protected. So if Ephraim was nervous about who was going to attack, they would say, hey, the guy behind me, the Shvatim behind me will protect me. Or the Shvatim in front of me will protect me. Dan did not have that luxury. They had nobody behind them to protect them. So their slogan was, Lishuasecha kivisi Hashem. In God we trust. Our salvation comes from Kadosh Baruch Hu, which in reality is something, a slogan that we all need to have in our own lives. But for Dan, it was something that they just didn't have as a slogan, but it was their reality. They didn't just talk about emuna and bitachon, but they lived it every single day when they traveled in the Midbar. So Lishuascha kivisi Hashem, that notion shouldn't just be a nice idea that we talk about, which is very important, but it should be a value that we live with in our lives when we go about, that we should have this emuna and this reliance on the Kadosh Baruch Hu, that he, the Yeshua, ultimately, the salvation comes straight from him.
Rabbi.
Yeah, go ahead, Nathan.
How can we have this emuna that Hashem is going to protect us when we see the people die all the time and things, bad things happen to good people all the time? So how can we feel that we should put our faith solely in Hashem?
So solely in Hashem. So ultimately, we need to understand, you know, there's a big debate these days about whether you make a bracha when you receive your vaccine. There's a big discussion about that. I have a list now, I think like five or six posts. I think six posts, and we've already discussed this at length.
Wally spoke about this in a shir, actually.
Oh, Rabbi Green spoke about it. Okay, great. Yeah. So yeah, it's, Rav Schechter was on video, made a bracha, Hatova Meitiv. So Rav Schechter didn't say, don't get the vaccine. You know, no. We need to do our part. Meaning get vaccinated. We need to do our part, wear a mask. We need to do our part, be socially distant. And at the same time, right, we have to understand where this is coming from. That I think it's, sometimes it feels like a contradiction, but the way that a Kadosh Baruch Hu created the world is that we have free will and there's divine foreknowledge. That we have, that we live a life where we need to do our part, but also that we rely on the Kadosh Baruch Hu. I think there's a, it's a very, for me, comforting when we can have this, you know, this duality. And again, how much hishtadlus, that's a different shear in terms of how much we need to do.
Rabbi Markowitz,
yeah.
Usually when you have a mass group traveling.
Yeah. Okay, Rabbi Lapp, we lost you. Hopefully, not forever. We will get you back, Rabbi Lapp. When you get back, let me know. Yehuda ata yaducha achecha. Yehuda, the bracha of Yehuda, if you look through the bracha of Yehuda, you will notice, I didn't look at it. I'm trusting in Rabbeinu Bechaya. Rabbeinu Bechaya says, I looked at the entire bracha of Yehuda. every single letter in the Aleph Beis appears in the bracha of Yehuda. Fascinating. One of the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Bechaya, pointing this out, right? Except for one letter. One letter. One letter is missing. Which letter? By the way, the most infrequent letters in the entire Torah are, anyone know? I think Samech and Zayin. There's very few, I think there's only two psukim in the whole Torah that begin with the Samech. So Samech and Zayin are, I think, are very, very infrequent letters in Torah. The letter Zayin is missing from Yehuda's bracha. And you could say it's coincidence. It's very rare. It's an infrequent letter. You're right. Maybe you're right. Rabbeinu Bechaya wants to teach us something. He says, maybe there's a lesson here. Yehuda in our parsha officially is given the mantle of leadership. Well, Yasser shevet mi Yehuda, Malchus should come out of Yehuda. The leadership, the Chashmonayim, the Ramban writes, their mistake was, is that they took the leadership and they didn't then, they were Kohanim, they didn't pass it along to Shevet Yehuda where it belongs. They kept it for themselves. Now it's a mistake. The Davidic dynasty is from Shevet Yehuda. What is missing from the bracha of this, of monarchy, of leadership? The Zion. Zion represents clay Zion. The word Zion itself is weapons in Hebrew. Zion Yud Yud Nun is weapons. That's the definition of the word itself. That's the translation of the word. That, why is that missing? Because usually we look at leadership, we look at a monarchy, we look at a king, and we say, where is their power? Oh, it's the fact that they have the nuclear, you know, football is being held on to. They could press that button at any moment. They have all the power. They have all the weapons in the world at their disposal. In a second, they could, you know, enlist troops and go in. And so Rabbeinu Bechaya says, if that's where your power is coming from, that's not leadership. That's not leadership. Greatness in leadership comes from the ability and the power to communicate, to not threaten or, you know, use your army and your might in that way. The might is through the sword. The might is through the pen. Right? What is the line? The pen is mightier than the sword. The power is through communication. The greatest leaders in Klal Yisrael were not warriors. They were great communicators with the Jewish people. Good morning, Sheila. So good to see you. So good to see you. So that is a very powerful lesson, not just for Yehuda and their leadership, but for all of us. But for all of us, you know, are we, when we tell people, are we telling people to do something? Are we threatening them? Or are we explaining why this is so valuable and so significant? You know, and that is the greatness is in the ability to speak, the ability. And you think about so many of the leaders of Klal Yisrael that we've lost over this past year. Their greatness, right? Rabbi Lamb, Rabbi Henkin 2 weeks ago, or Gedalia Dov Schwartz, an unknown, Rabbi Sachs, v'chule. Their power was in their ability to communicate to the Jewish people through their words of Torah, their hashkafa, their philosophy, through their books, through the piskei halacha. That is, when it comes to the Jewish leaders, that is the greatest way to communicate. You think about it. David HaMelech couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash. He might have been a great communicator, but he's also a warrior. That would be unhealthy. We needed somebody to begin who would just be somebody who would be a communicator, a teacher to Klal Yisrael, and that is more significant. So today we learned five different thoughts on the Parsha. Number one is, when did the Sheba begin? It was slow and steady. Something to think about as we live in the 21st century. We had the thought of Rav Schwab and Rav Yitzchak Rama, the difference between Yaakov and Yisrael. We learned that Shimon and Levi, Klei Chamas Mechir Rasam, what was the bracha or the klala of Shimon and Levi? They were spread out. Why is that significant? Lishuascha Kivisi Hashem was the banner or the slogan of Shevet Dan, and that's important for all of us. And finally, the mantle of leadership is given to Yehuda minus the Zion. He might have that ability to use that, but we should never go to use those threats. It should be through the ability, to communicate, really expresses
Rabbi.
Wish everybody a great Shabbos.
Rabbi.